best time.
Oh, really? K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name?
My call letter.
My name is Dick. And as usual, at Sunday nights, for the last 32 and a half years, we conduct the technical net. It's a gathering of curious people who want to know more about radio and wireless equipment and how to make it work better and how does it work. That's why they gather here. They usually get their questions at least partially answered. No guarantee on 100% accuracy. But it's kind of peer-reviewed material. By that I mean every one of these tech nets is recorded by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, and you go to his website at www.amateurradio.tangovictor, and there you will find 10 solid years of TechNet recordings. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and play back those recordings. For people who can't stay up as late as this TechNet runs from 8 until midnight, let me drop. Some people will download that recording a couple of days after the TechNet when it appears and put it on their playback device, whatever it is, and listen to it at a more convenient time. That's Mike, number one. Mike, number two, is K1MJM. He's got another website at www.technetlimark.com. Yeah, Limark. Yeah, I got it backwards. Limarktechnet.com, which has other supplementary information with reference to the TechNet. Tonight, we're probably going to be discussing a couple of slightly controversial subjects. One of those is the subject of transmission line radiation, RF in the shack. Rich N2EO is going to be bringing that to our attention, and whether or not you get better shielding out of twin lead or out of coax cable, whether or not you get great benefits out of having a local grounding rod, whether or not the grounding really makes a difference. Does the amount of radiation from your transmission line change as a function of standing wave ratio? Slightly controversial subject. Getting into that as the second person tonight. The first person tonight is going to be Steve, if he's available. KD2HUC has got a rather interesting question with reference to a really high-power solid-state amplifier, kilowatt-level solid-state amplifier, 80 through 10 meters, that he's in the process of constructing. Let me drop. So, as you can tell, as I was starting to say, the material by way of the recording, people listening to those recordings, when we make errors, and occasionally we do, we meaning the people who support this TechNet, that's K2RIW, Dick, John, KC2WGB, who maintains the mailbag and watches Echo Link and the chat room, keeps us informed as to what's going on there, Paul, WS2N, who gives us the space report. Tonight he'll be giving us space report number 209. This is technical net number 1,610 of the series that began in September of 1982. We also get contributions from Hal, K60BZ, who he and I occasionally disagree on transmission line radiation, grounding techniques, and so on. So you're going to hear both sides of the story, and you decide which one you like the sound of. Let me drop. And the way the TechNet is usually run is that during the first hour or so, sometimes it goes to 2 hours, we take sign-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. They can be the call letters and their name, and the word yes meaning they do have a question or a comment. And we take those in order. That's followed by the space report. That's first followed by the mailbag, and then followed by the space report. So that gives you the approximate week, loose schedule that we use. I already have KD2HUC signed in and Rich N2EO signed in. Anyone else who's got questions or comments for the TechNet tonight, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2IW, if you're listening.
KD2EZ with a quickie answer.
So do we have anyone else to sign in besides Steve and Rich who does have a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters right now.
KEPZ or the quickie dancers, okay?
Recognize the quickie dancers, KE2EJ. Eric signed it with a question. Anyone else besides Steve, Rich, and Eric? Give me a call letters and name right now.
W2OSR Bob.
Sounds like to OSR Mobile. Will you be in the area for a long enough period of time, Bob, so that when we get to you, you'll be within earsight? Over to you, Bob.
By the time he gets to me, I'll be in the chat, so it should work out well.
Very fine, Bob. Okay, once again, we got Steve, Rich, Eric, and Bob. One last call. Anyone else to sign up? Because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight. Give me your call letter and name right now.
NWS2N is here with the space report for later on. Good evening, Doug.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, Paul, you're going to be giving a space report number 209 tonight. Okay, let's see if we got Steve on frequency. KD2HUC. Go right ahead, Steve. K2IW in the TechNet.
Okay, KD2HUC here. Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the net. My question tonight, I sent to Dick earlier, is regarding the cooling of a solid-state transistor for a high-power amplifier. This is the first time I'm working with this type of transistor. It's Ampleon BLF188XR. And let me let it drop. So my question this evening is regarding interpretation of the data sheet from the perspective of how much heat will this transistor generate at full power so that I can properly design a cooling mechanism in order to keep the transistor running, you know, safely. So, Dick, I forward you the data sheet. I'm assuming you got it. I forwarded you some of my initial calculations. I do not know if they're correct. I do not even know if I'm interpreting the data sheets correctly because, like I said, this is my first experience with this device. So maybe you and Eric can help me out. KD2HUC, back to net.
I do help. Eric is on frequency because I believe by way of his broadcast experience, he has experience with that Ampleon device, BLF188XR. Is that it? BLF188XR, yes. XRS. This is a very healthy looking transistor with great big heatsink fins on it. And it says that it runs 70% efficiency and can run as much as 1,200 watts power output with 20 some odd dB of gain. An LD MOS device, really high power, high gain, very attractive looking device that can tolerate something like a 60-to-1 standing wave ratio continuously without experiencing any damage. Very rugged transistor. Let me drop.
The Freescale device, yeah.
Tell me what the word Freescale means, Eric. Give us some words on your experience with that exact device or one similar to it, that family. Go ahead, Eric.
Freescale devices, they make a series of 150 volts, kilowatt, actually 1.2. Actually, two FECs in a package, and rugged.
And I think the amplifier that Steve is about to build is going to be using a pair of these, a quadrature or a push-pull, I think it's push-pull network. Now, because the network, because the data sheet says that this device will run 70% efficiency, at say the 1200 watt power output, that tells me immediately it is not a linear amplifier. And that may not be bad, but digital television service where you are, Eric, the fact that it's not analog, so to speak, is not bad. We amateurs frequently like to run single sideband. That represents a little bit of a problem. A real linear amplifier, Class A, runs at best 50% efficiency. When you start getting into numbers like 70% efficiency, you're into Class C, where the device is not continuously conducting. Therefore, when it comes to a two-tone test for single sideband linear amplification, unless you rebias it and do some other things, you're not going to get a clean two-tone signal. It's my first impression. Let's see if you agree with that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW in the TechNet.
K2IW, K2J. No mistake, digital television is being digital, it's analog, as far as the RF segment of it goes. What specifically is the device number? Let me look it up.
Baker, Lima, Foxtrot, 188, X-ray Romeo, or X-ray Romeo Sierra. It claims 70% efficiency. I'm reasonably sure that unless you're running something exotic, like a Dougherty amplifier and some of these other crazy class of amplifiers, class E, F, and G, unless you do something really exotic, cannot get more than 50% efficiency out of a thoroughly linear amplifier. Since this is not running Dougherty, since it claims 70% efficiency, I'm reasonably sure it is running something like class C. In fact, I do remember seeing something on the data sheet where if you don't apply drive power, it doesn't draw any current. That's a pretty strong indication that it's not class A. A class A amplifier draws the exact same amount of current with or without drive signal, so to speak, with or without power output. So the combination of it turning itself off without drive and 70% efficiency tells me it is something like class C and therefore definitely not linear. For Morse code operation and for RIDI-like operation, no problem. But when it comes to single sideband, that might represent a problem, is my first guess. Over to you for comments on that, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. I'm looking at this device. It's Amplion who manufactured it. What I'm seeing here, all the different services that they're describing are class C. Even DVB-T is class C. And DVB-T, it's only 29% efficient, but that's also at higher frequencies. A wide band in terms of what it can operate. 75% efficiency is from 2 to 30 megahertz using 50 volts and getting 1,270 watts out. Is that the data sheet?
Yes, I think so. And as I said, 1,200 watts power output capability. Now, many of us have taken a afterburner-like amplifier, like say for instance a Mirage amplifier, which from my point of view is intended for FM service. A Mirage afterburner, like a Baker 216, I think is the one I'm looking at, Baker 1016, 10 watts drive, 160 watts output, works on 144, 148 megacycles. It is definitely class C. It doesn't draw any current, we don't drive it. And people have put 2 meter single sideband through that amplifier. It comes out sounding fairly ratty. And if you were nearby a bunch of other guys on 2 meters during a contest, and you're doing all of that splattering because of the non-linearity, your neighbors would not consider you very friendly. So there are ways you can rebias the Mirage amplifier to make it a lot more linear. And my guess is this Amplion device, if you were so motivated, you could bias it differently and force it to be more linear. But I think it would not do a very good job of reproducing a single sideband signal, is my first impression there, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Mike recognized, we're going to get to him in a minute. Eric first.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I'm looking at this thing here, and it's not what I would choose to use. Although you can bias it for class AB, that's not a problem. I'm looking at the curves, and it doesn't make me happy in terms of using this transistor, the curve transistors actually. So I agree with you 100%. Yes, you can bias it as AB. You can bias it as AB1, you can bias it as AB2, but this transistor is much happier and more efficient than class C, that's for sure. Not my choice, but yeah, you could use it. As far as getting rid of the heat, running a class AB, you're going to have a pretty good issue getting rid of it. Down at the bottom, the curves are not that happy. It actually draws a little more current as you move up in frequency. But yeah, you could do it, but it's not my choice. K2RIW, K2J.
Well, I don't think we should be that negative that soon, Eric. He already owns the transistors, I believe. He's in the process of building this amplifier. And his calculations on power dissipation because of 70% or 75% efficiency, which means 20 or 25% of the total input power is going to be dissipated as heat. And I think those calculations are correct. Now, Mike, I wonder if you've known of basically Class C amplifiers like the Mirage and maybe this thing, where people have done various things to make it more linear. And if they didn't, I think sideband comes out sounding intelligible but not pleasant, is my first impression. So, Professor Mike, WY2U, tell us your impression on all of the above. K2I, the TechNet. You got a mic.
CPZ with a comment.
Hal recognized. Mike first. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay, good evening all, WY2U. Well, I'm going to have to disagree, I think, with Eric, because this device, I believe, I'm interpreting one of the Class A B curves down around Figure 7 of the data sheet. I'm familiar, by the way, Motorola used to make a non-push-pull part. Interestingly enough, I think this is probably just very similar to two of them packaged in push-pull. You can bias in Class A B according to Figure 7. The quiescent drain current without signal at 50 volts VDS, they claim to be about 40 milliamps. Their measurements are done at VHF, at least that's the curve. The generated curve was done, they say, at FM at 108 megahertz. And I'm looking at a curve that's fairly linear, up to about plus 60, maybe plus 61 dBm, 1 dB compression. Now, of course, under those conditions, you're not going to get 70% efficiency. Let's not make any mistake about that. You're going to have to drive the bejesus out of the device to get that kind of performance. But I think you can easily get 50% efficiency. And according to the gentleman who asked the question, he says he's putting two of these devices, perhaps in quadrature. The device itself is biased, rather configured push-pull, balanced input, balanced output, which means you're going to get, if you choose the balancing network design properly, you're going to get a fair amount of even harmonic suppression. So I would probably surmise that the even harmonic distortion, the second, the fourth, etc., probably should be on the order of 30-plus dB down. And if you keep the device backed off to around 1 kilowatt at the output, I think the third harmonic can be suppressed about 20 dB, which could alleviate the severity of the filter requirements also. So I think what I'm saying is this device, I think, would work pretty well as a single sideband amplifier. Two caveats. Number one, you're not getting...
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, just as you started giving us the specific information in your last two sentences when the machine timed out, Mike, so please repeat your last two sentences. WY2U, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Sorry about that. I started my stopwatch about 15 seconds too late. I thought I was going to be okay. What I said was I think this device can be used admirably in single sideband service, providing two caveats. Number one, I don't honestly think you're going to get anywhere near 70% efficient backed off. I would bank on around 50 to 55%. And if you believe the curve that I'm looking at here in Figure 7, I think you want to keep the output power from each device at about 1 kilowatt, which is probably just under 1 dB compression, maybe half a dB into compression. Under those conditions, I think it would work pretty well as a single sideband amplifier. Jack, back to net. WY2U.
Yeah, very fine, Mike. You're giving Steve, the guy who's building this amplifier, KD2HUC, a lot more encouraging information. Eric, you also talked about using it at much higher frequencies. I think Steve only intends to use it on 80 through 10 meters, or maybe 160 through 10 meters. But devices with this much gain and this much isolation from input to output, most of the characteristics I read out of the data sheet are very desirable sounding. So with a little bit of font, I know this can be made into a rather good linear amplifier by ham radio services, purposes, so to speak, ham radio and standards. So wonder how much experience you've had with the, talking out to Hal. For some reason, the K6 keeps confusing me, Hal. I have trouble with the K6 New York area coming up with your name. Please excuse me on that. So, how much experience you have, Hal, with taking amplifiers that were originally designed as far as the data sheet is concerned, like the Mirage or like this Amplion thing, for Class C-like service, but making them linear? I think quite a few amateurs have done that very successfully. Some have had some struggle with it. K6TPZ, K2RIW, you got it, Hal.
K6TPZ, District ROW, Tank 2 ROW in Fifth Next District. Okay, I've had a lot of experience with Mirage amplifiers, rebiasing them, and as a matter of fact, putting them in the binders, and they're getting very high power on VHF. And it's not a hard thing to do. You know, they're basically working class feed. You have to introduce bias by isolating the bases, bias on the base circuits on Mirage amplifiers. It's a little project, but it does work. And you have a very good linear amplifier for 2 weeks I did, and I ran 4 of them with a combiner and got over 1,000 watts. So I like to use, I don't care if they're using FETs. I much rather use more forgiving than FETs. FET, many times, if a spike comes the opposite direction, it can take the drain source out very rapidly. So that's my comment. I'm going to go in. I just pulled in, and I'm going to throw some other information in. So you can't buy it and do a Mirage, but you have to isolate the bases, put your own bias network with little wires and chokes, separately set up the bias supply regulated, set the levels for the idling currents, and go down the road. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, sir, John. Very fine, Hal. Eric, I think you wanted to add some more to this. Go right ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm looking at figure 7 as the other gentleman was mentioning, and based on what I see, I agree with him. I wouldn't run it up that high. I'd use a pair of them. But one thing that the graph does show is the frequency that which that curve is created is at 108 megahertz, which you would assume would be FM, but I'm looking at the first curve in terms of frequency. Remember, its response is not quite as good in terms of power gain at HF. That's the only point. Actually, they don't even go down. The way the graph you read it, it looks like they're starting at 50 megahertz. And I really wonder how efficient it is at 10 or 20 megahertz. But going lower in frequency is more efficient, but they don't really give you enough information. But yeah, I agree with the other gentleman in terms of the way it's biased.
When you talked about the amplifier giving certain characteristics in the 100 megahertz region and then falling off at lower frequencies, I am guessing, Eric, that is a particular amplifier, a particular schematic they were testing. Transistors like this, I've never seen a transistor except, you know, AC coupled with a great big capacitor somewhere inside, series capacitor, that falls off in gain as you go down. Almost all of them go up in gain as you go down. And they usually go up in efficiency as you go down. And so I think there's a misinterpretation of the specs there. So this amplifier, which I have the impression has been used at 80 to 10 meter type frequencies, I think it can potentially do a beautiful job there. And by the way, your original question, Steve, let me drop it. Is that, have you calculated the power dissipation correctly? I think you have. The total number of watts that you've calculated, I agree with those numbers. Therefore, how much heat you've got to dump when the amplifier is being driven. If you use it in the way indicated in the data sheet, it essentially stops drawing current when you remove the drive. Therefore, it generates no heat during those periods of time. So it's the total heat you're going to be generating is duty factor related. You already know that, noted that. And therefore, for radio teletype service, which is a rather high duty cycle service, or really fast CW, you're going to be coming closer to those heat numbers. And so with the right kind of heat sinks and with the right kind of fans, dumping that number of watts of heat is not that difficult, in my opinion. Also, this device, I think it said it can tolerate numbers like 250 degrees junction temperature. This is a very rugged transistor. And let me drop it. That means, and it's got an internal thermal resistance, 1/10 of a degree centigrade or Kelvin per watt. In other words, for each watt it dissipates, there's only 1/10 of a degree of drop in temperature between junction and case. So it's got a very low internal thermal resistance. Cooling it is relatively easy with the right kind of a network that you mount it to. You probably have a number of more questions to you, but my impression is you intend to use this on 80 through 10 meters. And with the right kind of schematic, the right kind of a push-pull network in and out, I think this thing could work like a charm. KD2-HUC, K2LIW, go ahead, Steve.
I got one more comment when you get a chance to get
So let's take your comment right now, Mike, so that see if you can get us now the total questions on all of the above. WY2U, better known as Professor Mike, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay, Dick, very good. Yeah, comment for Eric, actually, because he was concerned about the possible lack of performance below 108 megahertz. I believe what's probably going on here is that the device probably has a whale of a lot of gain down there. And if I was worried about anything on the 160-meter band to 80-meter band, it would be stability. Usually what you do is you want to provide some kind of a feedback network. Now, unfortunately, as we were talking, I've been looking on the web here. I see a bunch of pictorials, but I do not see a schematic. I'm sure somebody must have a test circuit somewhere. I believe to stabilize this device and keep the gain reasonable so it doesn't soar and become unstable, probably some kind of drain-to-gate feedback network to limit the gain on the low end of the RF band probably would be in order. And I think Eric is correct, because once you do that, you're going to feed back energy back into the gate, and of course the efficiency is going to suffer somewhat too, so you may have to think about that also. But I think the main concern that I may have, if any, on this device would be stability below 30 megahertz. That was my comment, Dick. Back to next, WYPU.
Dick, take a quick look at figure 10. You'll see that the power gain actually starts off a bit low and increases as it goes in frequency.
Give me a couple of words on that, Eric. If you and I were designing a CD MOS device and we wanted it to have lower gain at lower frequencies, which is now no transit time problems, there's no input capacitive loading and output capacitive loading problems. How in the world would you and I design a solid-state device that goes down in gain when you go down in frequency? That's opposite of most things that I've come in contact with. How would you and I design one to do that, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
That's a tough one. Actually, depending upon the amplifier design and the feedback that you use, if you use feedback. Actually, I just noticed I made a mistake. I'm reading it as frequency. It's actually power output. So run it with a lower voltage, you get lower gain. Run it with a higher voltage, you get higher gain. And as you approach the maximum frequency in which the device operates, it falls off rather rapidly. So
that's the first mistake he's ever made on the TechNet. Okay, let me put a great big star in the book here, alongside of his call letters. That's one. I'm having fun with Eric. As I see it, Steve, you've got a rather healthy device here. Rugged as all hell. The only way you could create some damage is if you overdrive it and you put an excessive negative voltage on the gate. There seems like there's a little bit of a way you could do some damage, but with reasonable amounts of drive and reasonable amounts of bias, so you're not overstressing that gate. I think this device is built like a brick, you know what, a ceramic outhouse, to put it in a friendly language. So I think you're going to have a lot of fun with this. It's going to take a little bit of tinkering, but what else is new? And I bet you with the articles you've checked on, I'll bet you other people have used this and are relatively happy with it. Give us any information on all of the above, Steve. Looks like a fun project. KD2HUC. K2RIW, you got it, Steve.
By the way, according to this, we'll take a visual at 65 to 1 without killing it.
I don't know what it costs.
Yeah, it's a little bit pricey. And Steve's going to tell us how expensive it is. But, 65 to 1 standing wave ratio continuously. That output circuit is rugged. Go ahead, Steve.
All right, Dick. First, they're not cheap. These cost me $200 each. But I kind of anticipated the fact that driving this at the high end, given, you know, that we're such a far end of the operating parameters as far as frequency, that's why I'm using two of them, two independent RF decks into a power combiner. I didn't think to send you the schematic. I don't know why, but I will do that during this week so we can discuss it maybe next TechNet. Let me let it drop.
On a quick break, Steve, you intend to use this from what frequency to what frequency? I thought it was 80 to 10 meters. Maybe I'm wrong. You got to see. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, that's correct, Dick. I'm only using it in HF service. I do intend to use it in RIDI service. That's why I wanted it a little beefier than, you know, just a run-of-the-mill amplifier. I do, you know, listening to Mike's comments, I'm probably going to have to recalculate those heat losses, given that, you know, they're recommending that I not run it above 1 kW, and then accounting for only 50% efficiency at that level, obviously the heat loss numbers are going to go up. So that's something I'm going to have to refigure, but at least I know that I'm doing the calculations correctly. Let me let it drop. Considering the front end of this amplifier is a power divider, I don't think that the individual RF decks will see enough power to damage them. I will certainly forward the schematic of the total arrangement so that you and Eric and everybody else on the net can evaluate it and maybe point me in the right direction. So, but this is a lot of good information. It's very helpful because I probably would have been very disappointed if I just opened it up right out of the box. KD2HEC, back to net.
As long as you don't overdrive that gate and overbias that gate, you can follow the schematic. The data sheet that I'm looking at includes a recommended schematic and printed circuit layout as to how it's being used on one of its pages. So that was the test circuit under which they made those measurements, I believe. That's a push-pull network. Looks like a goodie. Anybody with any further questions or comments on this kilowatt class and above solid-state amplifier that Steve is building? Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call with us right now, K2LIW in the TechNet. And Steve is going to be checking in with us periodically to let us know how that project is going. And considering the price of afterburner amplifiers these days, I mean, the average guy who buys a kilowatt class amplifier, SB2000 like EathKit or the more modern versions of it, they're spending well above $1,000. Even if they buy it used, brand new, I think they're coming close to $2,000. So $200 for the transistors, which are pretty rugged and they're probably not going to be wiped out, I think it's a reasonable investment. Okay, Rich is the next guy on the list, N2EO. I hear tell you've got some RF in the shack. Rich, you're going to describe that to us, and we're going to make a whole bunch of suggestions as to what could and couldn't be causing it, and what there is to solve it. And there's going to be some differences of opinion on this one. This is one of those controversial subjects. On the TechNet, we've been down this road a few times, and various people have pretty strong feelings on the subject of grounding and transmission line radiation and RF in the shack. What causes it and how to fix it? N2EO, K2IW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Okay, good evening, all. N2EO. I'm sure you've been listening to me, Dick, so I gotta watch what I say about you. Yes, I'm not sure if I got one problem or two. I fire up this Henry radio amplifier. I'm getting about 1,300 watts out of it. First, when I fired it up last night on a 40-meter band, I would get output, and then all of a sudden, the SWR would jump way up. And if I let go of the push-to-talk, you know, going in the CW mode, and re-key it again, it would go into full power, and then the FWR would jump up. So I thought maybe something's breaking down in the antenna. Not sure. And you know, Dick, you helped with it. It's a compact, Cobra compact antenna, multi-band dipole that would open wire lines with balance. He size the balance goes with about an 18-inch piece coax to the tuna. On 20 meters, everything goes nuts. The power supply in Astron, the RF was so intense, it shut down the power supply, the crowbar circuit took off. The 80 meters, the whole transceiver, the Kenwood went nuts. I don't know what jockey what it was doing. Now, how K-60 dusted tin foil around the coax? Fallon and the tuna. Barry and 2MB climbed enough to selfie the sandfire in a very attractive price. In the morning, he said to me on the telephone, you need a ground. I discounted it, but I think between Barry and Al, they're probably right. I want to get your opinion. The only thing I could really do to enable ground is a ground board, which is very close out the window. Thing is, I don't have the money right now. The concrete goes right up to the foundation. To get an electrician to drill a hole, and I think a rod with Hilti. I have that done in white stone for lightning protection. I don't know what you think about that. The other way is to ground it to the wire outlet, ground plug of the Formex that was put in for the amplifier, but that may not suffice. Back to that MCO.
Yeah, there's a number of subjects we're discussing here simultaneously. RF in the shack, balloning, proper ways of feeding the open wire feed line that you've got. Yes, Barry and I were there when the dipole you're using was installed. It's a thoroughly symmetric dipole, something like, as I remember, 130 feet long, tip to tip, fed with open wire line. So, in theory, the antenna is thoroughly balanced. The antenna and the feed line. Now, what I'm concerned with is, what is the method of your balloning? In other words, your exciter is a coax cable going into the antenna tuner. The antenna tuner, I'd like to believe it has circuitry in there which is capable of feeding open wire line. Either that, or if you've got a coaxial cable coming out of the antenna tuner, and it goes into a separate balloning device. So tell me, what is the method by which you are feeding your open wire transmission line, and what is giving you confidence that you're feeding it in a thoroughly balanced manner? Let me drop this. By thoroughly balanced manner, I mean, if the right-hand side is 100 volts positive at this instant, the left-hand lead of the open wire line should be exactly minus 100 volts. Because open wire line, let's say for instance you've got 3 inches of spacing or 2 inches of spacing at 80 meters, that's a 1,000 to 1 ratio of spacing between those two wires.
Output says balanced output is It's my SW1 MM18-inch piece of cable going going over to the balance. That may be radiating like crazy, can't it?
Okay, power star balance. You said it's called a current balance. Is there anywhere in its data sheet or on its package or whatever that tells you what is the ratio? Is it intended to be 50 ohms in and say 300 ohms or 600 ohms out, whatever the whatever your open wire transmission line is? Does it state, first of all, what frequency region it's rated for, and does it give you the ratio of input and output impedance? Over to you, Eric. I mean, Rich, in 2EO, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, right on to the 4-to-1 balance. I'm going in with 50 ohm line, and I'm coming out with 450 ohm wire line. Power start, PAL, STAR, STAR. Power start, Inc., big, very high end stuff.
Okay, PAL star, and what's the model number of that PAL star?
Okay, the tuner was an 18-2K, and I don't... Balance is model D4001. So, deliver on the sea, Dick. You have to excuse me because I have cataracts.
Okay, you've given us a lot of information. So it's a PAL star, Baker 4000, I guess space 4/1, so it's a 4-to-1 balance. 4-to-1 from 200 ohms, from 50 ohms implies it's 200 ohms. You've got 450 ohm ladder line, so you're going to have a little over 2-to-1 standing wave ratio there. That's not serious. And ladder line, and by the way, the standing wave ratio is really on the input end, not on the antenna end, so to speak. So the open wire line should be happy as all hell. So depending on how that is being fed, is that PAL star balancing device? I presume it's got a SO239 connector that you're feeding it with, and then it's got two porcelain insulators coming out that goes to the open wire line. That's a guess on my part. Correct me on that one, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Larry. Yes, Dick, that is correct. It's an SO239 going in. It's a ceramic insulator coming out. By the way, I checked the connectors last night on the balun, on the back of the tuner, the amplifier, to make sure they were tight. They are all tight.
Everything I've heard up till now tells me there should not be any RF in the shack other than the RF coming directly from the antenna, when the antenna is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to radiate a signal. And when you run up close to the kilowatt level and the antenna is, let me pick a number, 25 feet above you, and the antenna is directly, the center of the antenna is right across the center of the house. In other words, if I drew a straight line from your head when you're operating straight up in the air, you're going to hit the center insulator on the antenna. So you're directly under the umbrella of that antenna. So you believe you have a RF in the shack because of transmission line problems. Let me drop. You believe it's because of transmission line problems. Right now, the evidence that you've seen leads you to believe that's what you're seeing. There's various ways we can find out. Is your transmission line hot? I mean, a grid dip meter held near the transmission line will tell you real fast if the transmission line is hot. And a neon bulb held near it, an NE2 bulb held near the transmission line with the right kind of instrumentation would let you know. So whether or not adding grounds are going to make an improvement is a little bit questionable. There are people who have great faith in grounds. I'm not a person with great faith in grounds. When you've got a thoroughly balanced antenna and a thoroughly balanced transmission line feeding it in a differential manner, that system should not have hot transmission lines. Adding grounds anywhere should not make any improvement. On top of that, when you do add a ground, you have some number of wavelengths of wire going to that ground. And that wire can have, that grounding wire can become further radiator. It doesn't, it makes an improvement in some cases, but now you're using a brute force approach to not solve the original problem. If you really had coaxial cable and lots of RF on the outside, let me drop it. If you really had thoroughly shielded RF coaxial cable, but you're using it improperly, like the shield goes to one side of the dipole and the center conductor goes to the other side, you will have RF on the outside of that coax cable. So what looks like a thoroughly shielded coax cable, and you ground the shack end of that, you have the best ground in the world, you're still launching a hell of a lot of RF energy on the outside of that coax cable, and with the best ground in the world, it's still going to be radiating like a banshee. So just going over the coax transmission line, which looks shielded, improperly used, it can radiate like crazy. So you can see that there are some reasons why I believe grounds are not going to be a glamour fix. Let's see what Hal's going to say on all of the above. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
K6DPZ, okay. First of all, I'm a firm believer in using a balanced matchbox, not a ballot. Richard, I will give you a Johnson matchbox, which has a balanced output. It's classic, and a 250-watt Johnson matchbox is good for 1,000 watts. It was designed for 250 watts AM, which is 1,000 watts peak power. I will give it to you, set it up, you'll get rid of all your problems, Dick. It's very simple. Go ahead, Dick. What's your comment on that one?
If we have a confirmation that the transmission line is radiating, open wire line properly used is the best shielded stuff in the world. It doesn't look it. It looks like it should radiate like a banshee because you see multiple inches between those two parallel wires. It looks like an open radiating structure. But because those two wires are less than a thousandth of a wavelength apart, as long as you have the exact same amount of positive voltage on the right wire and negative voltage on the left wire on this half cycle, it's the best shielded stuff in the world. In many cases, better shielded than coax. So what I'm getting at is, do we really have hot transmission lines? If so, my guess is either something is very unbalanced in the dipole itself, like a tree is loading down one side and not the other side, unlikely but possible, or something's not right with the balancing device. So where you're about to do a substitution of the balance, very good experiment. I'm 100% in agreement with that. So right now, this PAL star balance, is it really doing its job correctly? There are various tests you could run to prove whether that the PAL star is doing its job correctly. You could run it at the 1 watt level and confirm that the signal on the right hand side of the output and the left hand side of the output, the two porcelain insulators, are exactly the same voltage, exactly 180 degrees out of phase, floating with reference to Earth and so on. But there are various ways we could test the balance, but doing a balance substitution where you've got a known good one, beautiful experiment, worth doing. So right now, yes, you do have evidence of RF in the shack. We think it might be part of something to do with the transmission line. Maybe not. It could be that the fact that you're just right under the antenna itself, and the antenna is doing its job. And maybe the answer is going to be that the RF, let me drop it. The RF in the shack, when you run more than 500 watts, becomes so excessive that your power supply crowbar circuit trips out. In which case, until we get a chance to moving that antenna higher up, further away, or whatever, maybe the answer is you got to run 500 watts and you can't run a kilowatt, which is not a great disadvantage, as you know. There aren't that many pileups where that last 3 dB of power is going to make the difference of you getting in or not getting into that particular pileup. So I think you're going down the right road here, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K-Dick, N2EO. And Hal, let's see, I may take you up on that offer. Thank you. And Dick, I know there's all that in the shack because Frank Handel on the Roland Doctor is there. And I got a good RF burn on me yesterday to prove the point. Maybe what I forgot to tell you, on the 40 meter band, when the SWR abruptly went up, I got arcing. The reason I know I had arcing on one of the capacitors, I saw a orange flame come out of the tuner. Back to me.
Yeah, there's a website I could point you to which indicates that many amateurs don't quite do the job correctly of adjusting the C1 and C2 capacitor on a Pi network. They end up with light loading. Light loading of a Pi network gives you very high voltages. Very high voltages drastically increases the chances of arcing over. So if the C2 capacitor, the so-called loading capacitor, is set more in the open mode, less capacitance, that gives you heavier loading of the Pi network, and that can drastically lower the voltage that the capacitor sees, and therefore whether or not it's going to arc over. So improper loading of a Pi network can definitely aggravate the problem of arcing. And that was in The Doctor Was In, because that was the comment I made to The Doctor Was In a couple of months ago in QST Magazine, where I indicated the website you can go to that gives you the description of how to properly do that. So by you readjusting the way you do the loading, I'm pretty sure you can make an improvement on that one, Rich. And with any further questions or comments on the RF in the shack, and yeah, if you're getting an RF burn to your finger when you touch the handle, obviously, yeah, you've got RF in the shack. Now, where the hell is it coming from? That amount of RF coming from the antenna, I'm very doubtful. Now I'm beginning to agree with you. Something funny is going with the transmission line, and maybe that PALSTAR balancing device is not quite doing its job, and maybe the one that Hal is offering to you is going to be a great improvement. K2RB does W listening for anybody with any further comments on all of the above.
Rich?
What did you say, Rich?
The arcing I was referring to was not from the amplifier. The loaded it properly, was coming out of the tuner. Out of the tuner, I saw an orange spark come out of one of the caps. No air variable. So maybe the antenna does have to be moved to the other side of the house. I don't know.
Your driver amplifier, yes, it probably has a Pi output network because I think it's a tube-type amplifier. Your antenna tuner, in many cases, is another Pi network. The antenna tuner, when you set it so that you're getting the lowest possible standing wave ratio to your driver, you're setting an antenna tuner. You're setting another Pi network. What is your method right now, Rich, of making sure the antenna tuner is tuned correctly? Is there a standing wave indicator, like a bird watt meter, between the transmitter and the tuner? Is there a bird watt meter there? Is that the method by which you're measuring reflected power if the antenna tuner is not doing its job? Or is there an indicator on the transmitter? How do you know when you've set the antenna tuner correctly, Rich? Maybe it's got its own instrumentation. M2EO, K2RIW.
And you're doing it at full power.
Question. Yeah, Rich first, and then we'll go to question. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, take it. Here we go. Well, the antenna tuner has a built-in meter. Forward power, reverse power, and SWR. No, it's a crosshair needle meter. And it's not a Pi network, it's a T network. Okay, I think.
Pi network and T network have strong similarities in the way they behave. In either case, they can be set for improper loading. Person with a question, give us your full call and name, and then proceed with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
KD2HUC, Steve. Dick, I'm just curious. Rich, do you have a lightning arrestor in your transmission line? Because I had a very similar occurrence. About a month or so ago, where all of a sudden, I mean, everything was fine, and then all of a sudden I started transmitting on 80 meters, and the C2 capacitor would start to arc over, and after troubleshooting it, I found that I had a bad alpha-delta lightning arrestor. The gas tube, I guess, might have been arcing over, so I was just curious if you had that, because it sounds very similar to what I was seeing. KD2HUC, back to net.
You got it, Rich, right to the beep.
I know what you're talking about. Thank you for asking. No, I don't. There was no arrest or anything. Correct.
You got it, Eric.
I'm just wondering when he shows up, does he do it with the amplifier cranking out everything he can give, or does he do it at low power?
Tell us your recommendation on that, Eric. I think you're about to recommend that at some low power he sets all the knobs just right and then goes to the high power, because in some cases at high power indications go a little crazy. You can't push that too far, though. Some standing wave ratio meters, if you put them, if you give them too low a power, they're no longer reading correctly. KE2EJ, K2IW.
Yeah, well, if you're talking about a Henry 2K, it's a lot of latitude. You don't have to run a full tilt out of it. You know, a couple of hundred watts, and the thing is going to read just fine. Make sure that you calibrate the forward before you go look at the reverse.
Although it's a long shot, if you had access to a bird watt meter, Rich, if you put the bird watt meter in the line between the Henry 2K amplifier and the antenna tuner, so that right going into the antenna tuner, you confirm that it's giving a 50 ohm load to the high power amplifier. All of a sudden, I forgot the name of the damn thing. If you see, you know, something like 1,000 watts going forward and 10 watts coming back, or something like that, you know you're in good shape. So, to reconfirm the instrumentation of the antenna tuner is something worth doing. There's always a slim possibility that the indicator on the antenna tuner has gotten disturbed over the years. People have gotten into your antenna tuner and made changes. As such, when the antenna tuner reads 1-to-1 standing wave ratio on the input side, it might not be. So I'd like to see a confirmation done with a bird watt meter going into the antenna tuner. You see what I'm getting on that one, Rich? N2EO, K2IW.
A6DPZ with a comment.
Rich first and then over to Hal in that order. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, fine, Dick. Fine, Hal. No, no, it's not the old tuner. That one I gave up on. The power saw is brand new. Never been opened. And Eric is correct. I load up with low power and then bring up the amplifier slowly. That's it.
Okay, sounds like that in theory, that PALSTAR antenna tuner, let's hope that its VISWAR indicator is telling the truth. Long shot, but it's something I'd like to see confirmed. K6DPZ, K2IW, go ahead, Al.
Congratulations to me. K2IW and the test, K6DPZ. Dick, you mentioned about balance on the antenna. There may be an off balance, even though the center line is paired with better line. Well, let me tell you a very simple thing you can do, and you can find out if it's balanced on the antenna. Get two number 47 light bulbs, little pilot lights. That's three turns of number 18 wire, put across the pilot light as a shunt. Then connect your ladder line to each pilot light to your balum output. What you're doing, you're making a current sampling device to look at the current on your ladder line. Now, if the ladder line is balanced, both the brilliance on both the little 47 bulbs will be the same. If the line is not balanced, see, obviously, Dick, Richard, if you had a couple of current meters or thermocouple meters, that's the old-fashioned way of doing it, though I used to do it many years ago. But when you don't have a couple of thermocouple meters, use a little light bulb, you shunt it with a couple of turns of copper wire, so it makes a current shunt for the bulb, and then you can see if the bulb brilliances are equal on each line, then you know you have a balanced antenna. How do you like that one, Dick?
It's a good help. It's a necessary but not sufficient. There are various ways that I could take an NE2 bulb and have a sampling piece of wire connected to it, make a couple of turns. First, hold it near the right-hand lead of the twin leads of the open wire line, and hold it near the left-hand lead, and I could confirm that approximately the same amount of RF is on each line. That's a necessary but not sufficient, because I could do a crazy experiment where instead of using a differential ballonning device,